Okay, we'll try to spend most of the shiur today just giving a little bit of a background, a little bit of an understanding of the technicalities of the mitzvah of Milah, what exactly Milah is all about, when one does Milah, how one does Milah, who is the Moel, when is the Milah, etc. Things of this nature. So again, it's a mitzvah that we're obviously all pretty much familiar with the basics, but it's important for us to familiarize ourselves with some of the details, a little broader scope of how to perform this mitzvah properly. So when we speak about the mitzvah of Milah, we're really speaking about three different parts of the mitzvah of Milah. There are really three different physical actions that are involved in performing the mitzvah of Bris Milah properly. Let's break them down just for our purposes quickly. One is what's called Hasaras HaOrla, the removal of the foreskin, that outer skin, which that's the Ikar mitzvah of Milah. If a person does not have that skin removed, the person is considered to be an Orel, and we'll talk about what the ramifications are afterwards. That's the basic mitzvah, the removal of the Or, what we call the Or HaOrla, the outer foreskin. In addition to this, the Mishnah tells us that it is required that the Moel, at the time of the Milah, remove the lower part of the skin as well. It's somewhat of a softer membrane, which we call the Or HaPriya. The Or HaPriya also has to be removed in order for the person to be a Nimol. It's interesting to note that the Chumash doesn't actually speak about this second skin. If you look throughout the Psukim in Parshas Lech Lecha, which are of course the source for the mitzvah of Milah, the Torah always speaks about the removing of the Or HaOrla, of the outer skin, the harder skin, the foreskin, and no mention is made of this lower secondary skin, the secondary membrane. So the simple reading of the Gemara is that this is Halacha L'Moshe M'Sinai. This was part of the oral tradition, even though it's not mentioned explicitly in the Chumash, but it must be done as well. So those are the two most important parts of Milah, the removing of the Orla, as well as the Priya. Then there is a third part of Milah that the Mishnah, the Gemara discusses in Masechah Shabbos, and that's what's called the Metzitza. Metzitza means, themselves means to draw out, to suck out a little bit of blood, to draw out a little bit of blood after all the skins are removed, after that area is already cleaned up, one has to remove a little bit of blood as well, and that's what's called metzitza. Where in the world did this come from? So the removal of the orla is a pasuk in Chumash. The doing of the priya is halacha Moshe M'Sinai. Where in the world did the metzitza come from? So this was a major machlokes. So the simple reading of the Gemara is that the only reason for doing this metzitza was for medical reasons. That it was considered to be healthy to draw out some of the blood, to cleanse the wound a little bit. We're going to talk about how this plays out today. Very good. So the simple reading of the Gemara is that this was actually done for medical reasons, for health reasons, to literally clean out the wound, get the bleed a little freer to clean it out. That's the simple reading of the Gemara. There were other poskim who added on and said, no, it's not. That's not the only reason, that's part of the reason, but it is actually part of the halachic process of Milah as well, and it's necessary to be done in order for the Milah to be really done in the proper way. What's the practical difference, whether we view this metzitza as just being for medical reasons, or whether we assume that there's something more to it than that? So this may be the source of a very, very important machlokas. It's made a lot of news in the headlines over the last couple of years, which is as follows. The traditional way to have done metzitza was what we call metzitza bepeh, that the mole would actually draw out a little bit of blood from that area, actually using the suction, using his mouth itself. So there were poskim already years ago in Europe, already 150 years ago in Europe, who said that, who says that it has to be done that way? If the whole purpose of the Milah is just, the whole purpose of the metzitza is just to cleanse the wound, so then you could draw blood in any way you want. So what do you have to use? Your mouth, you get germs, you could use a clay, you could use a utensil, you could use a suction, you could use anything else that'll do the same trick. It doesn't have to be done in any specific way. That's what many poskim in Europe held. And the other poskim disagreed. Other poskim said, no, that it has to be done and the way it's always been done. It's an integral part of the mitzvah of Milah. We have no right to change it. And therefore, it has to be done metzitza bepeh. So this was the machlokes that, again, sometimes when you read the newspapers, you think this machlokes started 3 years ago. This machlokes was 150 years old. Whether the metzitza has to be done in a specific way with one's mouth, or whether one can do it with a kli. It was somewhat unresolved machlokes. Over the last 20, 30 years or so, so many poskim were strongly of the opinion that we should perhaps strongly recommend doing metzitza specifically with a kli, not with a peh, for a variety of reasons. So all of them health-related reasons, in light of of AIDS and other blood-borne diseases that have unfortunately become more prevalent in today's society. So we're nervous that for a mole to touch the blood, to suck the blood from his mouth, who knows what he's going to give the baby, what he's going to get from the baby, etc. So there are many poskim who strongly recommended that one should do metzitza b'kli. But I have to be honest that there were other poskim, especially in the Hasidic communities, who were vehemently opposed to any changes in Hilchos Mila and insisted that the Mila has to be done dafka b'peh the way it was done in days gone by. Again, so there are different mold about different practices about this. I would strongly recommend that unless one has some very compelling reason to the contrary, so I would strongly recommend my definite preference, without any doubt, is for Metzitza B'Kli, not to do Metzitza B'Peh. My two boys who did Metzitza B'Kli, we did not do Metzitza B'Peh. And again, it's a controversial issue. I don't want to get too controversial online, but suffice to say that you get a pretty good idea as to what my opinion is on it. Yes.
Itself,
right, so you're raising the question, maybe we shouldn't have to do mitzitzah altogether today. If the whole reason was for cleaning the wound, then we can come up with better ways of cleaning the wound. Right, so the truth is that's not such a far-fetched question. That question was actually raised by Gedol already a couple hundred years ago, and for whatever reason, we assume that it still has to be done. We're not 100% sure that that's the only reason, and maybe there is some additional reason, so we do it, but we recommend mitzitzah to clean as well as that.
If it's after the fact and it wasn't done,
if the whole mitzvah wasn't done altogether,
so the
pasuk pshat is that the meal was totally kosher. That's again according to the simple reading of the Gemara, the meal was totally acceptable. So now we have a little bit of idea what a meal is. Who exactly is obligated in meal? So here the Gemara tells us that there are really three different levels of obligation for bris meal. The first and foremost obligation rests upon the father, as the Torah describes that Avram was Ma'al Yitzchak. So that's the first chiyuv. The father has an obligation to be Ma'al his son. What if the father cannot do it? What if the father, he's not a moyel, he's not well trained. So what does he do with that under those circumstances? So then he has somebody else do it on his behalf. He hires a moyel to do it on his behalf. So there's a big machlekes at poskim. Does the principle of shlichos that we're familiar with in other areas of halacha, let's say for example, if I can't get around to doing my bedikas chametz, so I want to appoint somebody else to check chametz for me, so that's okay. So shluchu shalom kemel, so the shliach could do a mitzvah on my behalf. So can you apply the principle of shlichos to the mitzvah of milah or not? So some poskim said yes, why not? What's the difference? If I can appoint the shliach, let's say to shech the carbon on my behalf, I can appoint the shliach to give a get on my behalf, I can appoint the shliach to sell something on my behalf, I can appoint the shliach to do b'tikas chametz on my behalf, so I can appoint the shliach to do meal on my behalf. We have a rule that whenever I can do it myself, it's better to do it myself rather than delegate it to somebody else. But strictly speaking, shlichos would work. That's what many poskim said, that shlichos works for bris milah as well. And there are others who argued that for some technical reason, which I have to understand exactly why, that perhaps shlichos doesn't work for bris milah. So the father has to do it himself. What do you mean? But he doesn't know how to do it. So you're right. He's talking stuff. He doesn't know how to do it. So nebuch, he loses the mitzvah. Someone else is going to do it. He's got to get involved to do it anyway. He can't be an RL. But in terms of the father fulfilling the mitzvah, so the father technically does not fulfill the mitzvah if he doesn't physically do it himself. What's the practical difference? Practical difference is, let's say the father knows how to do it himself. So he is a mole already. He's a mole, but he wants to be mechabit somebody else. He wants to honor somebody else to do the milah. So if you hold that shlichos works, so then technically speaking, he can give it over to somebody else. It's not nice. It's not right. It's always better to do things yourself. But technically speaking, he would fulfill the mitzvah. Whereas if you hold that shlichos doesn't work for milah, and the father must do it physically himself, then he's going to be in a real pickle. Then if he hands it over to somebody else, he was in effect mevatel the mitzvah. He lost out the mitzvah. So we would strongly, strongly recommend that the father knows how to do the meal himself, so he should actually do it himself. That's what we pass in the halacha, that if he's a mole and knows what he's doing, he should do it himself. If not, so then nebuch has to have somebody else do it, either as a shaliach, or if not a shaliach, then he's going to lose out the mitzvah. What if the father didn't get around to doing the bris milah? What if the father's not around? What if the father's not alive? What if the father's not Jewish? The father's not from? The father's not interested? Whatever the case may be. So then who is next online in terms of doing the mitzvah? So here the Gemara says the obligation rests upon the Beis Din. That the Jewish court in that area, in that community, has an obligation to make sure that everybody receives a bris milah. When we speak about the obligation on the Beis Din, it doesn't mean literally the Beis Din, it means the tzibur, it means all of Klal Yisrael, whoever's around, whoever knows about it, has an obligation to take care of this mitzvah. what if the Beis Din never gets around to it? The Rabbanim down didn't know about it, couldn't do it, whatever the case may be, it never happened. So then and only then does the child himself become obligated in doing the Bris Milah, but that obligation only kicks in at the age of 13. Kol's man that he's under by mitzvahs, not having any mitzvahs. Once he becomes obligated in mitzvahs, then he's mechuyev to do a Bris Milah on himself, not literally physically on himself, but someone else has to do it on his behalf. So again, so you have three different levels of gradations of obligation. Father is first. In the absence of the father comes the Beis Din or the community. In the absence of the Beis Din or the community comes the child once he reaches the age of bar mitzvah. The most serious of these obligations is on the person himself for the following reason. If a person doesn't have a bris milah, they are chayav kares. A person is usually chayav kares only for isurim. If a person is over the bedazar, mechel shabbos, violates kibi arayas, etc. Those are averos. They usually carry with them a punishment of kares. The only two mitzvos, positive mitzvos, that the non-fulfillment of those mitzvos carry with them the most severe punishment of kares, are not offering a korban pesach, bizman shebeis hamikdash kayam, and not receiving a bris milah. So that's only true for the person himself. Let's say if I have a child and I don't give a child a bris milah, it's a terrible avera. Well, let's say if I know, I live in this commune and I know there are kids around and I don't have a bris milah and I can do something about it and I don't do it, it's a terrible avera, but I'm not chayav kares for that. A person is only chayav kares if they themselves remain as an orel for the rest of their life. There's a strange question that the Rishonim deal with. How could you be chayav kares for being an orel? Because if you eventually, let's say, if a person turns 13, so he becomes chayv in the mitzvah of Mila. So when he's 13, when he's 14, when he's 15, how can you say he's chayv kares for being an oral? Maybe he'll get a bris tomorrow. It's not like an aveir. An aveir, once you did it, mechal shabbos, finished. Whether you become a shomer shabbos next week, that's the nice thing to do, but that doesn't take away the aveir chal shabbos from last week. Whereas an orel is only chayav kares for being an orel, but once he gets a bris, so then it turns out he's never really an orel. So at what point does he become chayav kares? So when he dies and he didn't have a bris, once he's dead already, how can he be chayav kares once he's dead already? So it's a little bit of a roundabout question. So that's an interesting question that we should deal with. The Rambam and the Rambam, what does that mean exactly? It's chayav kares in the mitzvah bris mila. But Lamaisa the Torah says it. So whatever, it's a nice longish question you can ask under Rabban Shalom, but Lamaisa the Pasuk says it. So a person is chayav kares for not receiving a bris mila. The one person who...
At what point does the Beis Din assume his obligation
set? It sets in as soon as the father is not interested. When the father's not interested in doing it. Yeah. The one person who was not on this list of people who was obligated in the mitzvah of bris milah, surprisingly, is the mother. So this is a befeirish gemara in Maseches Kiddushin, Daf Chav Tes, where the gemara says that only a father has an obligation to be ma'al his son. A mother does not have such an obligation. It would be a nice thing to do. Let's say if the father's not around, the father's not from, the father's not alive, whatever it is. So if the mother can facilitate the bris, that would be a great thing to do. But in terms of her being technically mechuyevus in it, so she's not technically obligated in doing so. There are some who argue that even though a woman is p'tura from doing a bris milah as a mother, but she still may be obligated p'tura as part of the Jewish community. So let's say it comes to a woman's attention that there's a Jewish child who doesn't have a bris milah. The woman can really do something about it. She can convince the parents, whatever, she can convince whoever's in charge to give them a bris. Is she obligated to do so? So some poskim will say yes. Some poskim say that a woman doesn't have an obligation as a mother, but she has an obligation like any other Jew. Another poskim will say no. Women and Mila, nothing to do with each other. Women do not have a chiyuv whatsoever. It's not their mitzvah. It's not their parish. You don't have to worry about Mila. Their kid's an oral. It's not their problem. So there's an oral in the Jewish community. It's not their problem. So I once had a shayla that a woman asked me that in the course of our professional dealings, it came to her attention that a family that she was dealing with that the son did not have a bris milah. The family, if I'm not mistaken, I think the family was a Russian family. They had very, very little exposure to Torah mitzvahs. And she knew that this 7-year-old kid, whatever it was, did not have a bris milah. And the question was, what should she do about it? So she came to ask me, do I have an obligation to try to talk to the parents? I have a relationship with the parents. Should I try to explain to them how important this is? Or, you know, it's going to be a little, it was a little bit of a tricky situation, a little bit of a mixing, you know, religion and business, you know, a little bit of a question of professionalism. But the question was, Al-Pi Allah, is she obligated to try to do whatever she can, if it's possible, to kind of influence this family to see whether they would get a bris milah? So I responded by saying that there's a big machlokas whether you're obligated to do anything about it, but now that you told me, I have an obligation to do something about it. Thank you very much. So we tried a little bit, but I don't think it worked. I don't think we were able to be much later. But whatever it is. So a woman may or may not have an obligation, but if a Jewish male knows that there are Arelim around, so yes, one is supposed to try to do whatever is possible within normal reason to try to convince the parents or convince the guardians or convince whoever else is around if it's feasible to give them a bris milah. When we speak about a bris, so it's important for us to identify who exactly is going to do this bris, who exactly is going to serve as a moel, who is kosher to serve as a moel. So there are certain criteria that are necessary. One is that he has to know what he's doing. That's first and foremost. But besides that, there are certain specific objective halachic criteria that are necessary to be met for a person to be a moel. So one of the criteria is that the moel has to be Jewish. If the moel is not Jewish, then the bris would not be acceptable. What do you do if the bris is not acceptable? We'll talk about it a little bit later. What happens if somebody wasn't supposed to do a bris, did the bris? So is there any way to rectify that problem? But again, a non-Jew is not supposed to be a moel. Not only is a non-Jew not supposed to be a moel, a big question in the poskim, what if you have a non-observant Jew? You have a Jew who's totally non-observant, he's not Shomer Shabbos, doesn't keep anything, he doesn't keep the mitzvos, so can such a person serve as a moel? That's a further machlokes. So someone who's, again, technically, someone who's really not Jewish for sure or not, someone who's acting like a non-Jew would be somewhat questionable. There is a further question in the poskim, what about a woman? Is a woman acceptable to serve as a mohelet, we can call her or not? So believe it or not, there's machlekes and rishonim about this. And believe it or not, probably most rishonim hold it's okay. That me'ikar adin, we probably pass that a woman can actually do a bris milah. There are more rites that we have an age-old practice of not doing it. We don't permit, under normal circumstances, a woman to be a mohelet, because there is a view in rishonim based on their reading of the Gemara of Avodah Zarah that it would be a problem. There's actually a whole discussion about this, about Tzipora, because the simple reading of the Pesukim in Sefer Shmos was that Tzipora actually did the bris milah on her son. The question is, how could that be? So the Gemara itself does discuss this problem. But again, according to most Rishonim, probably a woman is kshera to be a mohel. Since some Rishonim disagree, our common practice is not to permit it. However, what if you would have a situation where there's mamish nobody else around? You have a family living on a desert island, and it's either the woman's going to do the milah, no one's going to do the milah. And of course, we would say that it's better for the woman to be the mohelet, since according to most Rishonim, that would be, in fact, an acceptable bris. Another important issue that has to be determined when you speak about doing the bris properly is the timing of the bris. So the timing of the bris, there are a few important halachas to keep in mind. So first and foremost is that it has to be on the eighth day. That's pretty explicit.
Sorry, going back to the other thing, for Mitzvah as well, does it have to be, does it matter, does it have to be done with Shema? Is that a...
Okay, what do you mean by that?
A lot of people, they get it done in a hospital.
Very good. So we're going to talk about that in a little while, about what if a bris was not done, it was physically done properly, but it wasn't halachically done with all these things that we're talking about. It was done by the wrong person, it was done at the wrong time, it was done the wrong day. So we're going to talk about, is there anything to do to rectify that or just leave it alone? So we're going to talk about that. When we finish the timing issues, then we'll get back to that in a minute. So again, so the most obvious halach is, as the Torah says explicitly, it has to be on the eighth day. A bris cannot be done under any circumstances before the eighth day. See, as we go on, if a bris was done before the eighth day, you may have to actually do something to fix it up a little bit later, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. But a bris must be done on the eighth day, and the bris has to be done during the daytime. Those two halachos are absolutely true. So it's got to be by Yom Hashmini, you cannot do a bris at night, and you cannot do a bris before the eighth day. Obviously, you can sometimes do a bris after the eighth day if there's some medical consideration. So the halacha is quite clear that if the baby it's not healthy right now, so then not only is one not required to do the bris on the eighth day, one is not permitted to do the bris on the eighth day, one would have to wait until the baby recovers. That would be basically the regular halacha of pikuach nefesh, the same way pikuach nefesh, the danger to life, pushes off Shabbos and Yom Kippur, etc. It pushes off the mitzvah of milah as well. How long do you have to wait? So the Gemara draws the following distinction. Let's say you have a baby that when it comes to the eighth day, there's nothing like terribly wrong with the baby. It's not like some life-threatening, serious thing. It's some small technicality that the doctors are cautious about, and they don't feel that it would be the best interest. There's a small chance that it may be dangerous to the baby to do the bris right now. Some of the examples that the Gemara gives are the baby is yellow, which we know, of course, is what we call jaundice today. The baby, the famous bilirubin counts. Any prevents here? no pre-meds. Okay, so basically what happens is that very often in newborns, the liver is not working 100% fully yet, and the body's having some trouble breaking down certain things in the blood, whatever. Again, I don't know too much about pre-med either, but that's pretty much what's happening. So there's a test that's called the bilirubin count that sometimes a young baby will have like a little yellowish tint to it, like a person who has jaundice has hepatitis. So that's a sign that the liver is not working 100% right yet. So it's considered to be not advisable to do a bris mila at that time. The Gemara speaks about the babies that are yellow. So you have to wait until the baby is no longer yellow. You have to wait until the doctors say it's okay. So sometimes you have situations where it's not such a serious issue. It's not that the baby's mom is deathly ill and, in a respirator or something. It's a much smaller type of a problem. So there, the halacha says that as soon as the baby recovers, as soon as the doctors give the okay, then you do the bris mila. But sometimes you have a situation where the baby is a real chola guf, to such an extent that the baby's in the neonatal ICU for the last 6 weeks, and now finally, Baruch Hashem, the baby comes out, so then you don't run to do the bris mila right away. Then the halacha tells us, the Gemara tells us, that you have to wait a full week. You have to wait a whole week from when the baby recovers, from when the point that the doctor gives you the okay. The doctor says, okay, you can do the circumcision today, then you have to wait a full week. Then, just as an extra special precaution, is it a precaution or is it a real halacha? It's a question where it comes from this week, but you have to wait a week. So these are all examples of what's called mila shelo bizmanas. Again, so mila shelo bizmanas is only going to take place if the baby is not well. Sometimes you'll be invited to a bris on the 9th, 10th, or 11th day, and sometimes if the baby was really sick for a while, then it's going to be at least the whole week after the baby actually fully recovers. Sometimes you have a strange situation. Well, you have to have a mila shelo bizman. You have to have a mila at the wrong time after the 8th day, not because there was anything wrong with the baby, maybe perfectly healthy, but the time that the baby was born was a problematic time in halacha based on the following. So we said that halacha is that a baby must have a mila on the 8th day or later, can never ever have a mila before the 8th day. So sometimes you can have a strange situation. A baby can be born ben hashmashos. So just a little bit of a background, ben hashmashos is that time from after the sun sets until the stars come out, which is the Gemara describes as a Suffolk Yom, Suffolk Laila. We're not exactly sure what the status of that time period is. Does it have the status of the day? Does it have the status of the night? So let's say we know from Hilchos Shabbos that we treat it like the Chumras, we treat it like the stringencies of both. See, we begin Shabbos, so once the sun sets, so one is not allowed to do any malacha whatsoever. There's a common misconception that a person has 18 minutes after sunset. That's a total, completely false. 18 minutes are before sunset. The 18 minutes are, women generally speaking light candles 18 minutes before sunset. So technically speaking, and that is 18 minutes, if one has to do malacha, one is still permitted to do malacha. Not the woman who put the candles, let's say the husband still has to drive to shul, he's stopping down the mincha, he's still in the shower or something. So he has 18 minutes from candle lighting until the sun actually sets, which is when Shabbos technically begins. Once the sun sets, under no circumstances whatsoever is a person permitted to do any malacha short of pikuach nefesh, unless it's some life-threatening situation. So I remember a couple of years ago, we used to live in the Heights, so I was walking down Amsterdam Avenue, and it was about 10 minutes after shkia, after the sunset, I see a guy getting out of a car. So I gave him like a funny look. So he says to me, Rabbi, what's the problem? It's still within the 18 minutes. I say, yeah, the wrong 18 minutes. That's 18 minutes from before shkia, not after shkia. After shkia is already an issa d'araisa, suffix issa d'araisa. But again, we're not convinced that Shabbos has started yet, because the stars haven't technically come out yet. But since it's a suffix yom, suffix laila, so we have to treat it l'chumrah, and we're not allowed to do malacha once the sun sets. It goes without saying, it would be very smart not to do malacha a few minutes before that also, because sometimes your watch isn't 100% right, sometimes the calendar isn't 100% right. Those who do malacha until the buzzer, until the sun sets, will inevitably be mechal Shabbos. So ben hashmashos is a suffix yom, suffix laila. So on Friday afternoon, we treat it like it's already Friday night. On Motzei Shabbos, though, we won't do malacha once the sun sets, because it's still a suffix yom, so we'll wait until the stars come out, which again is, it could be 25 minutes, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, 50 minutes, different opinions, exactly how many stars, exactly how late it's going to be. But that block of time between Shkia and Seis Kichavim is a suffix yom, suffix laila.
Yeah, but when it lists the time, that's before the 18 minutes.
Don't know?
When it lists the time, like if there's lists of when Shabbos
is. Yes, usually they list candle lighting time. So candle lighting time is usually given 18 minutes before Shkia.
So those
18 minutes after the candle lighting time is not technically Shabbos yet. Okay. Right, at least 15 of those minutes, 13 of those minutes. I mean, you shouldn't get too close to comfort. Right. right? That's the minig in America is 80 minutes. Yerushalayim, the minig is 40 minutes. They like candle lighting time, they're at 40 minutes before Shkia. So the person has a little bit more time. Whatever it is. Anyway, so now this halacha ben Hashmashos becomes somewhat complicated when it comes to a bris milah. Let's say you have the following. Let's say a baby is born tonight. What time is Shkia tonight? Who knows? What time is Shkia? 4:40, good. Let's say 4:40. So let's say, Mirat Hashem, tonight at 4:50, a baby's going to be born. A baby boy is going to be born at 4:50 tonight somewhere in the world. All right? So when do you do the bris? So when? Which day was this baby born? Was this a Wednesday baby or was this a Thursday baby? Right? So if it's a Wednesday baby, then you do the bris next Wednesday. It's the eighth day. If it's a Thursday baby, you count the eighth day, the first day the baby is born, that's the first day of the baby's life. So if the baby was born, let's say today at 4:20, there would be no question the bris is next Wednesday. If the baby would be born tonight at 6 o'clock, there would be no question the bris is going to be next Thursday. If the baby was born right smack between sunset and Tzitzkei Chavim, so when is the bris going to take place? So here the Mishnah tells us in Masechta Shabbos that you cannot do the bris on Wednesday, you must do the bris on Thursday. Why do you have to do the bris on Thursday? Because if you do it on Wednesday, you may end up doing the bris on the seventh day. You may be a day too early, and that's bad. To do a bris before the 8th day is out of the question. So it's much safer to do the bris on Thursday. You always opt for the second day. You always go for the later day, because the later day is always playing it safe. Either it's the 8th day or the 9th day. Well, you're allowed to do a bris on the 9th day. If the baby would have been sick, you could have also done the bris on the 9th day. So if you have a choice between doing the bris on the 7th day or 9th day, do it on the 9th day. So the bottom line is, whenever you have a baby that's born by a shmashos, you always push it off to the later of the 2 days. This is important. Anyone's wife who's going into labor late in the afternoon, so should really be aware of this, unless you know you're having a girl. But if you think you may be having a boy, so then I've had many fathers have called me, you know, an hour or so before Shkia, the wife is in contractions and she's having a baby soon. It's going to the doctor said another hour or so. So I said, keep your eye on the clock. Make sure you see exactly what time it is. And because sometimes a question of a minute or two may make all the difference in the world. Let's say if Shkia is 4:40 today, if the baby's born 4:35, so it'll be a Wednesday bris. If the baby's born 4:41, it's going to be a Thursday bris. So it's important to keep this in mind. Mitzvah Shem, time comes, you have babies, so Mitzvah Shem, you have to
rely on whatever they write in the birth certificate.
The birth certificate is not always right. The birth certificate is not always right. I think my daughter, if I'm not mistaken, I think she's written down as a 6:28, and I think she was a 6:30, or one of the other. I remember at the time, I saw what the nurse was writing, and I looked at my watch, which was right, and it was off by 2 minutes. So don't trust what it says in the birth certificate. We said before that a bris has to be done in the daytime. Therefore, a bris should not be done ben hashmashos. One has to make sure to do the bris before shkia. Now, under normal circumstances, that would never come up. You do the bris in the morning. It's the reason of the mitzvah. You're supposed to do a bris the first thing whenever you're able to. As soon as davening's over, you should really do a bris. That's under normal circumstances. But sometimes there are pressing, extenuating circumstances that push us to have the bris sometimes a little bit later on in the afternoon, if that's the case, whether justified or unjustified. So one has to be very, very careful not to run into problems, not to do the bris after Shkia. When is the earliest in the morning that one can do a bris? So the Mishnah says that, technically speaking, the day begins what's called Alos HaShachar, at dawn. Anyone's been up at dawn recently? So it's pretty dark outside. Very, very little, the tiny, tiny rays of sun. You can barely even see it when you're regularly walking around the streets of Washington Heights. You're not going to see dawn. If you're on a plane, so you can see. If you look all the way in the east, you see the beginnings of the rays of the sun starting to come up. So that's considered to be Alos HaShachar. So technically speaking, that's when the day starts, and that would be the earliest time to do a bris. The Mishnah nevertheless tells us we're supposed to wait not to do a bris until the sun rises, which is a good hour and a half or so later than that, because we're afraid that if you do it before the sun rises, you may come to make a mistake. You may come to do it too early, and sunrise, everyone's going to be pretty. Sunrise, you can't miss the big red ball that comes over the horizon. So when you see the sunrise, then you're allowed to do the bris. So you shouldn't really do a bris before that. That's why sometimes in the wintertime, this becomes problematic, because sometimes the sunrise can be as late as 7:30. So sometimes people want to get out of there, want to go to work. So they call the bris minion for 6:30, and then at 7:05, they're already doing the bris, and they got to wait 25 minutes before you're allowed to do the bris. You have to be careful about that. If you're making a bris in the wintertime, be careful. You should not do the bris lechatchila until after sunrise. Again, so the basic timing for normal bris is on the Yom HaShemini, on the eighth day, and dafka bayom v'lo b'layla. So what if all these things that we've been talking about, something went wrong? Namely, we have the wrong guy being the moel, the non-Jew being the moel, or we have the bris was done at night, or the bris was done before the eighth day. What do you do? Is there anything that has to be done to rectify these problems or not? So this was a big, big machlokes Sapolsky. So there were many Rishonim who said that the family didn't finish. You didn't finish. The kid's not oral anymore. He's not chayakaris anymore. He doesn't have the oral was removed. So what's the difference? Whether the oral was removed by the doctor in the hospital, whether by the non-Jewish doctor was removed on the third day, was removed in the middle of the night. In the end of the day, the kid's not oral. So what do you want from him? There's nothing else to do about it. And other Rishonim say no. Other Rishonim say that even though it's true technically, the bris is over, there's nothing you can physically do, but there's something that you can do up the halacha to, in a sense, rectify the problem. That's what's called a tofas dam bris. It's based on a Gemara in a few places in Shas. A tofas dam bris, latif means to drop. It means to draw a little bit of blood. And you make a very, very tiny, tiny, tiny little scratch to draw a tiny drop of blood from that area where the mila would normally be done from, and that atavas dam bris is like a substitute bris mila. Like if you goofed the first time, so then you do that in place of the actual mila. So there are different opinions in the poskim. Some poskim say that if it was a goy did the mila, you have to do that. And if it was done too early, you got to do that. If it was done at night, you have to do that. So there are different opinions about this. Again, anyone who has any particular shayla should speak to Rav about this. But this is a question: if the bris was done incorrectly in the first place. This is assuming that the whole orla was removed. If the orla wasn't removed properly, and there's physically orla there, so then obviously the bris would have to be done properly in order that the person should no longer be an orla. But even if the bris was physically done properly, if it was halakhically done improperly, that would be this question, whether there's anything at all that has to be done, and just leave it the way it is. When we speak about the timing of a bris, so there's an important halakha to be aware of, and that's the halakha that a bris is docha Shabbos. Even though doing a bris on Shabbos involves malacha, involves a very serious malacha, you're drawing blood, you're making a cut, a surgery, things that would normally be prohibited in HaTorah to do on Shabbos. This bris is the exception to the rule. The Gemara derives from a special pasuk that a mila b'yom ha-shmini, a mila b'zmana, is deicha Shabbos. It overrides Shabbos. However, this is only true if a few conditions are met. This is only true if it's actually a mila bismana. What if it's not bismana? What if it was delayed? Let's say the baby was sick, and now the baby's no better, and now it happens to be Shabbos morning, is the first time we can do the bris. So then one is not permitted to do the bris under any circumstances if it's a mila shalom bismana on Shabbos. That would be tantamount to chil Shabbos deraisa. So it's a special kula that the Torah gives, a special heft that the Torah gives us for a mila bismana, but not for any other, not for any mila shalom bismana. Since the halacha is that only a mila bismana is doich Shabbos, you have to be certain that it's zmana. So you could have a very complicated situation. Let's say you have a baby that was born ben hashmashos, that we spoke about before, but it's a complicated ben hashmashos. The baby is born Friday afternoon ben hashmashos, so Friday going into Shabbos. Let's say this Shabbos, probably going to take shkir before 4:40. A baby will be born this Friday night of Beit Hashem at 4:50. So when do you do the bris? So remember we said before that whenever you have a ben hashmashos baby, so you have to do it on the second of the 2 days. You can't do it on the first day, because that's too early. That may be the seventh day. So you have to do it on the second of the 2 days. So if you follow that logic, the baby would be born at 4:50 this Friday night. When we do the bris, you have to do it on Shabbos. You can't do it on Shabbos. You know why? Why can't you do it on Shabbos? Because maybe this baby was really born on Friday. Because we don't know what 4:50 is. 4:50 is Nishtin Nishtin. It's right between sunset and the stars coming out. So we can't do the bris on Friday because it may be the seventh day. We can't do the bris on Shabbos because it may be the ninth day. So we get stuck. We're in a pickle. So when do you do the bris? You can't do it on Friday. You can't do it on Shabbos. When do you have to do it?
Sunday.
That's what the Mishnah says. So Sunday we know is not the eighth day. Sunday is either the ninth or the tenth day. We have no choice. What are you going to do? Our hands are tied. So that's the halacha. That's what the Mishnah says. If a baby is born ben hashmashos, so Friday going into Shabbos, bris can't be done on Friday, can't be done on Shabbos, has to be done on Sunday. The shaila can become even more complicated because just as a mila bismana is docha Shabbos, but a mila shalom bismana is not docha Shabbos, the same is true for Yom Tov as well. Only if it's the eighth day do we do the bris on Yom Tov. If it's not the eighth day, then we don't do the bris on Yom Tov. So now we're in a little bit of a pickle in the following case. A baby is born Friday afternoon of Ben Hashmashos, 4:50 this Friday, and happens to be at Sunday as well. Sunday, not this Sunday, but happens to be in a case where Sunday happens to be Yom Tov. So now what do you do? So Sunday is the first day of Pesach. Sunday is Shavuos, whatever it is. So now what would the halacha be? So you can't do the bris on Friday because it's a day too early. You can't do the bris on Shabbos because what? Because it may be a day too late. You for sure can't do the bris on Sunday because Sunday is Yom Tov, so it's Shalom Bismana. So when would you have to do the bris? On Monday. And what if it's 2 days of Yom Tov? Let's say in Eretz Yisrael it's 2 days of Rosh Hashanah, or what if in Chutz Laaretz it's Yom Tov Shen Shavuos. So then you have to push the bris off. So you, in theory, you could have a situation where a baby's born on Friday afternoon and we're doing the bris on Tuesday. That's right. That's the din. If it's born ben hashmashos, so we're in a pickle. So we had this in a shul this past year. So this year, Shavuos was, I think, Friday and Shabbos, if I'm not mistaken. So we had a baby that was born the week before, Thursday afternoon, going into Thursday night, 22 minutes after Shkia, 22 minutes after sunset. 22 minutes after sunset is probably, oh, it's on the borderline, it's probably still called ben hashmashos. So now the shayla is, when are we going to do this bris milah? So to do it the following Thursday, out of the question, plus maybe the day early. To do it on Friday, Friday was the first day of Shavuos, so it's you can't do it on Friday. To do it on Shabbos is absolutely out of the question. So now we have to do the bris on Sunday. That's the thing. That's halacha. Sometimes you have a strange situation, you have to push the bris all the way down till the Sunday. There is another important consideration not everyone's aware of, that a bris can only be done on Shabbos if the baby was delivered naturally. If the baby was delivered through a C-section, then the Gemara derives from a pasuk that you cannot do the bris milah. Such a milah is not doicha Shabbos. There's actually a machlokes in the Gemara, machlokes in Rishonim, but in Shulchan Aruch we pass it that you under no circumstances can do the milah of a yotze. It's called a yotze dofen. Literally, dofen means a wall. So yotze dofen means the baby came out through the wall rather than coming out the regular way. So a baby, it's a yotze dofen, a cesarean section, cannot be done on Shabbos. It's important to be aware of that. There are a lot of babies that are born C-section today. Okay, we'll talk about that next week in Hilchot Pidyon HaBen, why that's true. But the bottom line, the reason why it's true, is that doctors are much more nervous with any complications in the middle of birth, so they'll opt for a C-section much quicker than perhaps they did in the olden days for insurance reasons, medical reasons, a variety of different reasons. So the bottom line is there are a lot of C-sections being done today. The numbers in America are something like 1 in 4. About 25% of the babies today are born through C-section today. So it's an important, fairly common common shaila. So halacha is that if a baby is born through a C-section, so it's not going to be Dorcha Shabbos, you would have to push the bris off until Sunday. Remember we had in our shul 2 years ago, baby was born on Shabbos. The guy was all excited. He calls me on Shabbos, tells me my wife just had a boy, and we're going to make a bris and shul on Shabbos, and we're all excited and everything. So he said to him, okay, wonderful. You know, how does everything go? How's your wife feeling? So he said to me, well, it was very tough. They had to do a C-section, the last section. I said, hold on 1 second. He said, they had to do a C-section. I have no bris in my shul on Shabbos. I said, the bris on Sunday. He said, what? The 8th day of Shabbos. I said, I don't care what the 8th day is. I said, that's what the halacha is. The halacha says you don't do it on Shabbos. So he had never heard of that. He's a fine ventari. He had never heard of that halacha. So I gave a whole shiur that Shabbos and shul, why the bris wasn't being held that day, why it's being done the next day. Anyway, that's the din. When we say that a bris is Deicha Shabbos or Deicha Yantif, which part is Deicha Shabbos? So the bris itself is Deicha Shabbos. What about all the preparations for the bris? Let's say the mohel has to fix his knife, or the mohel has to carry his knife, and there's no eruv, the mohel has to do other things. So this was a machlekes hatanoim between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva. It's actually a fascinating machlekes. Rabbi Eliezer's opinion was that just as the bris itself pushes off Shabbos, so do all preparations push off Shabbos. And Rabbi Eliezer said that, let's say, the mohel realizes that he doesn't have a knife. He doesn't have a knife, can't do the bris milah. So the Rabbi Eliezer says, no problem, he can make a knife. How's he going to make a knife? He's got to melt down metal. How's he going to melt down metal? He's got to make a fire. So he's got to make a fire, it makes a fire. He doesn't have wood for the fire. So Rabbi Eliezer says, you can chop down wood, chop down trees. That's one malacha d'oraisa. You can start a fire, the second malacha d'oraisa. You can melt metal, a third malacha d'oraisa. You can form a knife. Malacha after malacha after malacha, perfectly okay, in order to make sure that a milah takes place in Shabbos. And Rabbi Akiva disagreed. Rabbi Akiva says, no, when the Torah says that milah is lecha Shabbos, that means the milah itself is lecha Shabbos, but nothing else. Not the preparatory, not what we call the machshire milah, not the preparatory stages. Only the milah proper, the Shabbos, nothing else. And we paskin like Rabbi Akiva. The Gemara tells us a fascinating story that before the Shaila was decided, before it was paskin against Rabbi Eliezer, so Rabbi Eliezer's Shita was still a valid Shita. We have a rule in Halacha that as long as there hasn't been an official psach against a particular Shita, so those who are Tamidim of that Rebbe can follow that Rebbe. So Rabbi Eliezer's Balabatim, his Tamidim, follow his opinion. So the Gemara says that they were rewarded for following his opinion because they were so makban and milah, even though according to Rabbi Akiva what they were doing was chilul Shabbos, they were so rewarded for being so careful about the mitzvah of milah that they would chop down trees on Shabbos to make knives. So the Gemara says, once the Romans decreed that the Jewish community weren't allowed to do Mila, but that town of Rebbe Elazar somehow got spared from the decree. So the Gemara says that was in reward for their special, extra careful fulfillment of the mitzvah of Mila, even though Allah, we don't really pass in like them. So again, that was before it was decided against them. Now that it's been decided, the Beis Din, the Sanhedrin has decided, voted against Rebbe Elazar, under no circumstances is the person allowed to follow Rebbe Elazar. One has to do all the preparations beforehand. There is a machlekes haposkim. Let's say a person forgot to do a certain preparation. You don't have a knife. Can you ask a goy to do it for you? So there are many poskim who say that amir liakom, you're allowed to ask a goy to do whatever's necessary for the milah. Because normally we don't do amir liakom. We're not allowed to ask goyim stop to do things for us on Shabbos. But if it's to enhance the milah, the yom hashmini, that would be permissible. Once we had a very fascinating shaila. We had a...
Hey, what happens if someone does a bris for a child that looks for a C-section on Shabbos?
It's called Chil Shabbos.
Okay,
means the briska. I mean, the baby is technically mahul. Yeah, the baby is mole. It's hard to say that the baby is not mole anymore. But the ma'aser, the mole is Chil Shabbos. Yeah. Yeah. So I had the following shaila came to me that it was on Friday and you had this baby that was born on Shabbos and it was supposed to have the bris tomorrow. The problem is the baby was a little bit jaundiced. So what they do today, as we mentioned before, they check, they call the bilirubin count. They check, give blood tests to the baby every day or so to see whether the bilirubin numbers are coming down. If the numbers are coming down, that's a sign that the liver is working properly. So usually what they do is, usually this jaundice starts to come up, if they're three or four, so somewhere in the middle, the baby starts to turn a little yellowish, so they start to check the bilirubin. So the doctor will check every day and see where the numbers are. So this particular baby on Friday, the numbers were a little bit high. Different doctors, different mother have different standards, you know exactly. Usually it's not so important what the number is, depends whether it's going up or down. If the let's say it starts at 15, whatever it is, it's already down. The next day it was down to 13, it's down to 12, whatever. Again, I don't remember the precise numbers. But if the doctor will see that it's going in the right direction, the numbers are going down. So that's usually a sign that everything is okay. So this particular baby, they tested the bilirubin on Wednesday, and it was a little bit high, and Thursday is a little bit lower, Friday. They weren't 100% comfortable with the numbers yet. The doctor didn't want to give a green light to this baby to have the bris mila tomorrow. But the doctor pointed out that maybe by tomorrow, the baby may be fine. He may be able to have the bris tomorrow, we just don't know, because we don't know what the numbers are. We're not going to be able to do the blood test tomorrow. So the question was, what do you mean you can't do the blood test tomorrow? Have a non-Jew come, the non-Jewish nurse will come to the house, she'll draw a little blood, send it to a non-Jewish lab, they'll process it in a few hours, by 3 o'clock in the afternoon we'll have the numbers. So it could be that by 3 o'clock in the afternoon they'll come to the realization this baby is perfectly okay, you can do the bris mila mamash today. So I told them they should do that, that's exactly what they should do. They have the goyim test the blood and have the goyim do all the work. And when the guy comes and tells us that, yeah, this baby is okay, so you didn't have a bris at 8 o'clock in the morning, so what? You have a bris at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. If it's this, you could have a bris at 8:15 if it's before Shkia. So that's what happened. So that's what happened. I thought that was okay.
You definitely can't do that in Israel.
Right, it would be pretty hard doing Israel.
Also, isn't it a little bit risky? Because you don't really know who's doing all this stuff. Okay. Like, who's in the lab, who's Jewish, who's not Jewish, who's testing it.
Now the question is, you know, do we have a right to rely on Rove? I mean, most people, you know, if the nurse comes to the house, usually when someone comes to the house to draw the blood, you have a pretty good idea whether the person is Jewish.
No,
I mean, not always.
When they're sending it, especially if you're in New York.
Okay, so it depends. But it's a Rove. You know, the question is, Rove, people, you know, yeah. It's set up to Hackensack Hospital. I think most people working in the lab at Hackensack Hospital are Jewish. I doubt it. I would doubt it.
Let's say when the nurse came to your house.
Her name is Devorah Cohen or something. I would say she's going to shul. She shouldn't be taking blood for your job. Right. Right. No, Hanami shouldn't do that.
So you wouldn't be able to do that to see if you could do the bris on Sunday. I mean, if Sunday was the 8th day, you couldn't do it on the 7th day to see if you could do the bris the next day.
Well, what do you say? You could do a test on Sunday. You could draw the blood on Sunday.
See if it's
going down. But to be able to tell, I don't think so. Really, Yaakov was mutter for Mila Bismana, but that was the happen.
No, but if Sunday wasn't.
Oh, you mean Mila Yaakov is the only way to make sure to do tomorrow's bris for Mila Yaakov today. I don't know. Somebody should say the reason why they were mutter Mila Yaakov on for Mila Bismana is because since the Torah was mutter, the Malach itself, so the Chamar can be more mutter in the Torah, you know, Hov Nitl Lidach Hasek Shabbos. So that's why I wouldn't applaud him. To a Sunday's mana, because but a Sunday's mana isn't the Shabbos. I don't know. It's not Lomdish Shabbos. Interesting Shabbos. Okay. a few other things to be aware of at a bris. So there are a whole series of brachas that are recited at a bris. So the first bracha that's recited is the obvious bracha, Asher Kedisham Tzotzav Al Hamila. So that bracha is recited by the Mohel. Then there's a second bracha that's recited by the father, Asher Kedisham Tzotzav Lachnisa Bevrisa Shlav Mavino, which is the whole question, why in the world that second bracha is being recited? You just said a bracha a second ago. So what's the significance of the second bracha? So there are different opinions about this. The Rabbeinu Tam's opinion is that this bracha is not really on the mitzvah of Milah. This bracha is more on more kind of a celebration of the Shevach, a big praise to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, giving us this wonderful institution called Milah, but it's not really a brachas ha-mitzvah in the classic sense of the word. This is like a big question in the Rishonim. The bracha we recite under the chuppah, you know, is a bracha right before you get married. Asher kidishonim mitzvayis zivano al arayos v'yasalonos arusos. Right, a long bracha. So there are some rishonim who say that's a bracha on the mitzvah of getting married. That's like a bracha you say before you eat matzah, before you blow shofar, before you put on tefillin. And others say no, it's not a bracha on the mitzvah of marriage. It's a bracha on the institution of marriage. It's a brachas hashevach. It's a praise. Rather than a brachas mitzvah. So some Rishonim connect these two. Rabbeinu Tam connects these two brachas that lachnisa v'risa shlav avinu is not really a bracha on the mitzvah of bris milah. Others disagree. So my nafkamina, who cares whether it's a bracha this, a bracha that? At the end of the day, you have to say it. So the difference would be as follows: when do you say it? Do you say the bracha of lachnisa before the bris, or do you say it after the bris? So there were two different traditions in the Rishonim. Some Rishonim said you say it dafka before the bris. Another Rishonim said you say it dafka right after the bris. So we have a little bit of a split psak. The Rosh in the Shabbos writes that the only way to really say it properly is to say it right between the two parts of the bris. When we start out the Shabbos by saying that you say first you do the milah, you remove the outer skin, and then you remove the underskin, the membrane, the priya. So the Rosh says you should say lachnisa right smack right then and there, right after you did remove the arla, before you do the priya. The only problem is that today most of them today remove the arla and the priya in one shot. So they use a one cutting motion. So in the olden days they would split up. There were different traditions of how to do it also in the olden days. But the Rosh clearly was working with the assumption that you're having two different actions. Whereas today, most Molim do it in one fell swoop, so it's very hard to get that bracha in. So what our minhag today is very simple. Our minhag is, the Molim makes the bracha, Asher Kedisham Tzotzav Al Hamila, and he starts to cut. And as he's cutting, so the father screams right ahead, Asher Kedisham Tzotzav Lachnis Avishlam Avinu. So the father's got to be in line, he's got to be ready to go. Many bris in my mat. So the mom makes the bracha alamila, and the father's starting to fumfka for the city. He's looking for the art school. He can't find the car. He can't find the place. So that's not right. He should be ready and rolling. Right as soon as the mila is started, he should be reciting the bracha lachnisa b'isa shlam avinu. After the bracha of lachnisa, then there is another series of brachas that are recited. There's the bracha of Bar Priya Gofen, and there's the bracha of Asher Kidesh Yedid Bibet, that a long bracha that appears at the end of the Gemara in Sugi Masechta Shabbos, that's recited after the baby is all mild, after the meal is over. So you recite these two brachas. These two brachas are usually not recited either by the mom or by the father, recited by somebody else, someone who has one of the kibudim, to recite these brachas. After these brachas, so then the baby is named, and that's pretty much the seder advarim in terms of the halachic part of what takes place of the bris. Just a few side things, a couple of important ha'aras to be aware of, that there are a whole series of different kibudim that take place at a bris. So one of the biggest kibud is what's called the sandak. So the Chazal speak about the Maila being a sandek, that a person has the baby is brought into the bris on the knees of the sandek. So that's considered to be a tremendous kavod. We have a custom that a person is only a sandek for a given family only once. Let's say if I was a sandek for Reuven's older son, so I'm not a sandek for Reuven's younger son. We try to, since being a sandek is a big bracha, it's a big kavod. Some say it carries with it a school of getting rich. So we want to spread out the wealth. So that's the minhag. That's what the Rambam writes. That's what a minhag is. You only become a sandik once for that particular family. In addition,
the grandfather.
Right, so the grandfather usually is a sandik at one of the
persons.
He shouldn't really be. He could be for other grandchildren from other kids of his, but one father shouldn't appoint the same person to be a sandik for us. That's the minhag. That's what our minhag is for a variety of reasons.
Smart also.
I'm not really smart about that minhag. I don't know.
It's better to take someone from outside the family and reuse a grandfather.
Yeah, you should reuse. That many is we don't reuse the grandfather. Usually there are two grandfathers. Usually one grandfather gets the first baby, and the second grandfather gets the second baby, and then usually the Rav will end up with a baby, and an uncle will end up with someone will end up with a baby.
The father ever
the son? The father, not really. I mean, in theory it can be, but it's not. I mean, the father's ever really the son. Then there are a couple of other kibbutzim that are given out of bris, one called the kvata. So kvata are the people who actually bring the bris in. You bring the baby into the bris. So usually what happens is that it usually combines a husband and wife team. So usually what happens is that the wife brings the baby to right to the beginning of the shul, and then the husband usually takes the baby from her, and then he actually brings the baby in. And there are a few other kibbutzim that's called kise shel yo. We have a custom that Eliyahu HaNavi comes to a bris in Chazal, say. So we want to welcome Eliyahu HaNavi, so we set aside a chair for Eliyahu HaNavi. So the minhag is that once the baby is brought in by the kvata, so they put the baby on the, what's called kiseh shel Eliyahu. So someone just gives that cover. He takes the baby and he puts it onto the chair. Then there are a few little tefillahs that are said by the mole at the time. Then they take the baby off, and then they give the baby off to the sandik to begin the mila itself. There are different minhagim as to how many kibbutzim you can turn this into. So some will have one kvata brings in, one kvata brings out, one person who puts onto the kisei, one person who takes off of the kisei. So depending on how many people you have to honor. I remember when I made a bris for wife, it was my oldest son. So I asked the Moel, Rabbi Katzenstein, the famous father-son team of Moelim in town. So I asked Rabbi Katzenstein, I said, just tell me exactly how many kibbutzim I have over here. So his response was, he says, you tell me how many kibbutzim you need, and I'll tell you how many kibbutzim you have. So he said, you need a kibbutz, I'll make it up to you. So I've been at some bris, and I've taken a long time. It looks like they're tossing, you know, the baby from one, like a handoff, double reverse in the backfield there. But anyway, the kids said those are all different minhagim about the sandik is an important thing, and the kvat is an important minhag, and kisa shel yo is an important minhag as well. After the bris is over, so there's an idea of having a suda. It's considered to be a suda's mitzvah, and one is supposed to participate in the suda. That's where the minhag comes from, that we don't invite people to a bris. We just tell people about a bris, because Chazal say that if somebody invites you to a suda's mitzvah and you don't come, so that's like a bizoyan to a Kaddish Baruch Hu, so that's not a nice thing. So therefore, the truth is, it should really be true for weddings also. We shouldn't invite people to weddings either. We should also just modia, just I guess that's what an invitation is. We should just call it information. But also this mitzvah is really the supplies. But a bris somehow became more common. Nobody invites people to a bris. They just call up and inform people when the bris is going to be. One is supposed to participate if one's able to. One should eat it at the bris. Sometimes you have a situation where you can't eat at the bris. Let's say if it's on a tainus, on a bris on Yom Kippur. So no one can eat at the bris on Yom Kippur. Bris on Tisha B'Av, so you can't eat on Tisha B'Av. So or any other tainus tzibur, so you have to push the suda off until the night time. So that's what we do. We had a bris in shul on Yom Kippur last year. Not especially a year before, so you have to improvise a little bit. You have the suda, motzah, Yom Kippur. It becomes a little complicated in terms of the drinking of the wine also. Usually you make a bar piyagofen. Obviously in Yom Kippur, you're not going to drink the wine. So there are different opinions what you do with the wine. So what many do, at least the Ashkenazim do, is that on Yom Kippur they give a little bit of the wine to the baby. And it's a whole question in of itself how that works. The baby doesn't answer amen, so that's a question how that works. And on other tiny tibur, so we usually look for a child who's not fasting, who's too young to be fasting, so we give them a little bit of the wine to drink.
Does the suda happen specifically that night?
I think it's supposed to be at night. It's supposed to be a tziruf. You know, you can't do a mitzvah now and do a suda in a month from now. So if you do it at night, that's understood. That's a mitzvah to the ma'is of the bris meal itself. There is another sudas mitzvah that's associated with the bris, and that's the quasi suda of shalom zocher. Shalom zocher is there's a question. Some poskim actually hold it appears in the gemara itself. The idea of shalom zocher. Others had a different reading of that gemara. But whatever it is, shalom zocher is an age-old practice. That at least in the Ashkenazi communities, it's an age-old practice that the Friday night before the bris, so they have a little bit of a suda usually after the suda, a little bit of a little cake, a little stuff, a little things. There's a minhag that in many of the communities they serve arbis, serve chickpeas at a shalom zocher. So the reason for that is the Taz writes that he thinks that the real reason for shalom zocher is that it's supposed to be like a nicham aveilim for the baby, because the baby's so sad that that it, here it was learning Torah and Shemayim for 9 months, now comes to this world, there's no Torah anymore, it's not going to go to yeshiva for a few years, so it feels so bad, it forgot all of its Torah, so we try to cheer the baby up, we menachem avel to the baby. So when you menachem avel, you always give somebody something round to eat, so you eat bagels, they eat eggs when you menachem avel. That's a gal gal achoz of olam, that even though you're sad now, but the world keeps on going, and that's going to be happier later. So we try to cheer up the baby a little bit, we give him nichem avelim. So I discussed my oldest son, his Shalom Zach was on Tisha B'Av, literally on Tisha B'Av. It happened to be that year he was born in Zayin Av, and that year Tisha B'Av fell out on Shabbos. So you don't fast on Tisha B'Av on Shabbos, you fast on Sunday. But he had to make a Shalom Zach. So he made a Shalom Zach on Leil Tes B'Av. So it was a very strange feeling. So I gave a whole shiur at the Shalom Zach about what the significance of Nicham Avelim of a Shalom Zach was all about. So since then, I must have given that Shtetl Torah about 25 different Shalom Zachs over the years. So every time we always say that Shalom Zachar, that, but the first time I said it was on that first Tisha B'Av Shalom Zachar with my oldest son. Okay, so we try to give a little bit of an overview of Bris Milah, but some Yetzirah next week. So we're going to move on to Pidgin Abed.
Thank you very much.
So, you guys done Milchah now? You know,
Pidgin.